And guess what? We are back. And it is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and I'm very pleased to have as a guest right here in the studio, Terry Watata, The Three Pleasures is the title of his novel. And Terry, hey, thanks an awful lot for coming in. We're really glad to see you. And well, you are family. This is family day. You were once a CIUT man.
I was. I've been interviewed twice by Nick Beat, great name. Yeah. And I forget the name of the show, but they asked me to interview a jazz musician from Japan, Yosuke Yamashita.
Uh-huh.
And so I went out and I did the interview, recorded him, came back, and put it on air.
Oh, great. Well, we're going to ask the archives guys at some point. You must be curious. But
well,
but now listen, music's a big part of your life. I'm noticing you. Terry Watata is a poet, a playwright, a musician, excellent columnist. You write for the Bulletin. What's the name of the Bulletin?
Vancouver Bulletin. Very simple.
And what I recommend to people is that you just write the name Terry Watata. It comes up, and then you hit news, and then it'll be a little waterfall of really interesting things going on. This novel, I have to say, I guess the way for me to speak of it is it's a cautionary story. It couldn't be more timely because we have War Measures Acts and we have big decisions about identifiable groups.
Yes.
And you're telling us a story through a novel, which often, as we all know, tends out to be the real thing as opposed to carefully written histories. Let's start by getting a picture of the Japanese Canadian community, 1941. They sound I love reading about them, and thank you for the glossary. What was this community, the size of it? What was the feel of it on Powell Street?
Yeah, well, there was a large concentration of Japanese Canadians in the Powell Street area in the east side of Vancouver. Of course, not the entire Japanese Canadian community, but it was like its own town, you know. It had its nightclubs, it had its bars, it had its stores and residents all throughout the area. And everyone spoke Japanese. It's the only place that they could speak freely in that language. And they had their own religion, Buddhism, which started in Canada because so many were going to the Christian church because there was no other church available. And so the elders of the community said, well, we need a Buddhist church too, not so much for the religion, but for the cultural and, you know, and the traditional imperatives to be passed on to the Nisei generation or the second generation.
Yes.
And it was a vibrant area, time. If I had lived there, I would have really enjoyed it, I think.
Well, your character, and we always suspect the author of being the central character, Danny, the young man who's going to UBC, and he's recruited to the New Canadian.
Yes.
He's a real nice kid, and he just wants to play jazz and baseball.
Yeah.
And he's starting to get interested in young women.
Yes, of course. And writing, because he took he majored in English literature at UBC, and because Tom Shoyama approached him and gave him this wonderful opportunity to write. Now, he didn't know anything about writing for a newspaper, and so it was a learning process that he went through. And, he just a regular guy, as it were.
And the Japanese Canadian community were fishermen, they were lumberjacks, they were gardeners, and they were merchants.
Yes.
And they were a stable and a community minding their own business.
Yes. Well, you take my father, for example. I mean, he came to Canada, when was that, 1920, 1921, and by his father, and started him on the railroad. I forget what he was. I don't think he was a porter or anything like that, but he worked as a laborer. Mm-hmm. And then other jobs came along, in farming and lumbering. I think that was the big thing that he got into.
Yeah, and but there was, as your book points out, there was already a shadow over this community from what we call the Anglosphere, I think. And so there was, but they were coping. They understood that, but they would cope very nicely, actually.
Yeah, even though there were a lot of laws against them, labor laws that restricted them, and they did everything they could. They worked hard to make their way in Canadian society, and I think that's part of the animosity towards them.
Yes, the fishermen. They were excellent fishermen.
Yeah, exactly.
You could do a whole history of them and the innovations they brought to fishing.
Sure, sure.
I was just reading. Prompted by your book. Your book, it really did impact me a lot. You know, just the even after all this whole experience, Japanese fishermen developed ways to catch very difficult, the sockeye salmon.
Right.
They developed a technique.
Sure.
The sockeye, you weren't supposed to be able to catch it, but they caught it. but let's get to, let's move to then the clouds move over. There is a backdrop of Japan and Germany, and people are talking and looking, I suppose, at the Japanese-Canadian community. And then the storm begins with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And I have to ask you, I have to tell you, I was shocked by your book, startled on what you talked to me about. This very nice young man, Danny, is sitting at a cafe, and the music is interrupted, and the news comes that the Pearl Harbor has been bombed. He jumps up, he and his friend, and they run home. He gets to the home, and he is an English-speaking Japanese-Canadian. He runs into the house where his mother is, and she is a Japanese-speaking Japanese-Canadian. And he says to her, "Mom, the Japs have bombed Pearl Harbor." And I wanted to say, well, first of all, in the deep heart of that woman, there must have been a moment where she said, "Just kill me." My son says that word, and here I am, helpless. Such things happen, I guess. That language was used.
Sure. They tried to make a distinction between Japanese Canadians and Japanese, although they didn't call themselves Japanese Canadians, you know. They just called themselves Canadians. Mm-hmm. And if pushed, bullied, then they would call themselves Japanese.
Yes.
But the second generation, the first generation born in Canada, wanted to be Canadian.
Yes.
And I guess the mother's reaction would have been to pause and look at her son.
Well, of course, in the book, she doesn't believe him because he's her boy.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Why listen to him?
That's
and
right.
She, at, no doubt at that point, she would like to talk to another adult who now has to save that young man. And there's so many of them in your book, people trying to save their kids and not let the terrible world get to them.
Right. That's very true. And they, in turn, did the same to the third generation, my generation, basically tried to protect them.
Yes. Now, so something, let's go, you walked us through this. And by the way, my sympathies go out to poor Danny because you knock him down a flight of stairs, you shove him out the door, he hears it lock, and then it starts to rain. I mean, this young man, you put him through by giving him a writer's job.
Yes.
He gets to go everywhere, and everywhere people are in pain.
Yes.
And he also goes through quite a bit of a transformation.
Indeed.
Hastings Park, what was that?
It was the PNE. It was part of the PNE, the Pacific National Exhibition, like our Canadian National Exhibition. And the Hastings Park itself was a horse barn. That's where they kept all the horses. And the authorities that be, I guess, the powers that be, said they needed a huge space to gather all the Japanese Canadians from outside Vancouver. And they put them in there. And they, first of all, they segregated them, although the kids were allowed to stay with the mothers. The fathers were placed elsewhere.
And young men, right?
Yes, yes, I mean, yes.
Frankly, right away, paranoia has set in. They're trying to get the young men and the males.
Yes.
Who are, one assumes, think of themselves as protecting their family, ripping them away from the family.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, initially, before Hastings Park was established, the government came in and arrested all the able working men and young men and took them away to labor camps in the interior of BC. They weren't told where they were going. The families were not allowed to contact them in any way. They weren't informed where they were. And this is what they did. This is what happened to my father. Yeah. Middle of the night, the RCMP came and knocked on the door. And I think they did that because they knew they would be home.
Yeah.
And then took them away into the night.
There's something you put in your book. The first guys to be picked up had opinions.
Opinions. That's right.
They said, and your young man and the others are sort of watching the Mounties move around through town.
Yes.
And who are they picking up? People with opinions.
That's right. Whether it be the ministers or the teachers especially. Whoa, can't have that.
Teachers teach, don't they?
No, they do. They do. and of course, the leaders of the community. And they did not like what was going on, obviously. And so they were arrested.
How long were people in Hastings Park? And that, you're saying they put them in the barns, basically.
Yes, they did. It was a vast space.
How many? Like 8,000, 3,000,
4,000? Oh, total. I mean, they cycled them in and out, right? So yes. There must have been, oh, God, thousands, more than 10,000, I would think, going through there. And they stayed anywhere from a month to a year, maybe longer. I don't really know.
Yes.
But it was called, euphemistically, the distribution center.
Yes.
So they were waiting for
from the— From where to where.
Yeah, yeah, the camps in the interior.
Well, let me toss out the word concentration camps. I grew up thinking they were concentration camps. Then I was told they were something else. And then, you know, it's been raining euphemisms, actually, since my mid-teens.
Yes, yes. Well, I think—
But what else are they if you put a fence around? Not everybody had a fence around it, but there were some, certainly did.
Well, back east in Ontario.
Well, and you couldn't leave Hastings.
No, oh, no, no. That had
barbed wire.
You were
being concentrated.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's very difficult to get out of there until you were assigned somewhere to go. As I said, it was called a distribution center. But, yeah, in the final analysis, it was a concentration camp for them.
Yes. And on basis of what? Here we have, we want to remember, there's another enemy, a famous one with a mustache. There was Germany.
Yes.
And there were many German Canadians and many German Americans.
Yes.
They had formed in the United States groups called the Bund, where huge rallies of enthusiasm for Adolf Hitler and his friends had been organized. They did not, as a community, get rounded up and put in custody. They picked up the people with opinions in that community, right?
Right. Right.
But the Japanese were treated as one entity, a child, a woman, a grown man. They have one thing in common, the Japanese.
Right, right. Well, first of all, they were obvious.
Yes.
You know, if you're a German-Canadian, you could just change your name or deny that you had anything to do with Germany, and then you were left alone.
Yes.
But there is another factor in this, in that the BC politicians saw an opportunity here. They said, well, we can get them out of the fishing industry. We can get them out of the logging industry and all the other industries that they were involved in and take over again. BC actually declared itself a white province.
At that time?
At that time. Sure, even before that time, you know, they wanted
it. It was before, but then they made it official.
Yeah, that's right. I think, and I know the military and the Mounties went to Prime Minister Mackenzie King and said, why are you wasting all this time and effort and resources to get these dirt farmers off the coast, mm-hmm. right? But he had been lobbied by the BC politicians. This is our chance to get them out.
And that underlines a story that I want everybody to understand here. As that war progressed, and the Japanese Canadians stoically, for the most part, endured this insult, they were given a decision was made that they would never go back. They would not be allowed back.
Yes.
And they did not, in fact, they were not able to go back until 1949.
That's right.
Couldn't go back.
That's right.
So, and then the other choices were you can go east, or here's one for you. How about going back to Japan?
And give up your citizenship.
Give up your citizenship.
Yes, that's right.
This is the Canadian government. But by the way, in cahoots with similar philosophies coming from, I have to use this word, I like Chomsky introduced it, Anglosphere. Anglosphere. The Australians to this day have not apologized what they did. There is no apology in Australia.
Right.
But this is, tell us what happened to the fishermen, to the boats. It's in the novel. I recommend people read this novel. It's Terry Watada, The Three Pleasures. Pleasures is an odd word, but we can explain. Terry Watada, The Three Pleasures. There is a description. And you, one of your heroes, Watanabe, I believe, rose and fell as a result of that struggle to have some dignity in the process. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, first of all, the government, again, in his wisdom, rounded up all the fishing boats. I think they were afraid of is it the term fifth column?
Yes.
Yeah, it's forming with fishing boats against the Canadian Navy. So they rounded
Japanese
them all.
Canadians had a bigger navy than Canada.
That's right. Yeah. Well, they rounded all the boats up and put them in dry dock. And then promising that they would be taken care of and given back to the fishermen after the war. And, of course, that was a lie. They sold them for pennies on the dollar so that they could give it to the veterans of the Canadian military when they came back. Mm-hmm. And they, as they did with the properties, too, farms, businesses, buildings, they did all that to them as well. And the veterans got the benefit of the that, if I can say largesse, yes. But yeah, so fishermen, I met a man in southern Alberta who very silent. I knew his daughter, but he was mute, it seemed. Mm. And he kept looking up at this spear on the wall over his mantle, and I couldn't ask him. He wouldn't answer me anyway, but I asked his daughter. He says, oh, that's his whaling spear. He was a whaler, and he had to give it up because he lost everything through the government.
Yeah.
And so he looks at it with, I guess, nostalgic eyes. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, now, another detail is, I think it comes up, it definitely comes up in your novel. You said, okay, you can go east. Can you go to Toronto? No.
Right. Right.
Toronto never told me that. I've looked around. I didn't know. How did they do that? A city decision?
It was a city.
They said, we don't want them here?
That's right. It's restricted. You know, you could not come in if you're a Japanese Canadian. Yeah. Now, if you were already there, they didn't kick you out. Or if you came in as a student, U of T, for example, then you could come. Or if you were established already and you sponsored someone to come in, then it was all right.
Yeah. By the way, in terms of white decency, decency on the part of ordinary people, there were some sparks. By the way, not many in your book, but because I don't think that they saw many. There's a famous man, Linus Pauling, in the United States.
Yes.
Then there was the American Friends Service Committee, my favorite. These are Quakers. They, I understand, offered scholarships and whatnot and tried to help Japanese Americans, and I don't know if they did the same here, to say you could go to this school, we will, you know, help you get there.
Yes.
Let's be honest, that was few and far between.
Yes, there were church groups in Ontario that helped them settle, mostly outside of Toronto, of course, St. Catharines, Hamilton, places like that, and I know they helped a great deal.
Mm-hmm. I'm from California originally.
Oh, yes.
And The Japanese Canadian Japanese Americans started to return late 44.
Right.
And it's a thriving community. They did return. And it's, by the way, I mean, there's a parallel phenomenon here in terms of the apologies or the word redress. The decision was taken. But it struck me that there was a little more animus here. Is it because it were part of the British Empire? What was it? There was this idea that it were British and the other races somehow don't.
Yeah, as I said, I think the BC politicians saw a chance to keep British Columbia white, whereas in California, it was over. Mm-hmm. You know, Japan was losing or had lost the war, and so they said, well, let them back. You know, it's their property. We didn't sell it off.
Yeah.
And so they came back.
Yes.
Again, in the United States, it's an interesting parallel between Mackenzie King and FDR. I mean, they again, the military went to FDR. Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover went to him and said, come on.
Yeah.
We can't waste money doing this to these dirt farmers. Who cares? And FDR said, I've got to look like I'm doing something. Oh, my God.
Yes. That's the scary part about wars and power.
That's right.
And so throughout your book, we are running into people who have what you can call discretionary power.
Yes.
And they become evil.
That's right.
If they get a chance to hurt you, they'll do it.
That's right.
I want to point out that you tell this story without basically heroes. I mean, the word hero comes up somewhere in here, but I don't see a lot of heroes. Yeah. And you're not even interested, I don't think, in heroes. You describe a man who's the Black Dragon Society person.
Yes.
And there's also the man who actually followed the emperor or who felt, look,
that's right.
No matter which way I turn, they're going to treat me like a Jap, and I may as well just be the part because they've already made me the enemy. And you really understand him. You follow him through to the sad moments in Angler, Ontario.
Yes, yes.
Talk about those guys. How do you feel about them?
Well, I discovered them by talking to some Niseis, supposedly in confidence. But they told me that some of them told, not everybody, but some of them said, Japan is going to win the war 6 weeks tops, and that's it. You know, they are unstoppable. They're going to win. Now, some of them were taught in Japan. Mm-hmm. You know, they were born here and raised here, but they went to Japan because better career opportunities. Mm-hmm. And, of course, so they were inculcated with the Japanese nationalism. Now, I suppose I can understand them believing that Japan would win. It's the other ones who were born here and they were raised that way, and I mean in the Canadian system, and coming to the conclusion that Japan would win. And so, and others told me about this group in Petawawa initially, and then they moved over to Angler, but they.
Yamamoto Boys?
The Yamato Boys.
Pardon me.
That's okay. But they would bow to the sun every morning because the emperor is the sun. Mm-hmm. And they pledged allegiance to the emperor, and they really believed that they were going to win.
Yeah.
And they kept on to that. I mean, even in the face of Hiroshima.
Yeah.
They said, well, that's a lie. That didn't happen.
Well, that's what nationalism does lead to.
Yes.
But by the way, I mean, in this case, this is a nationalism encouraged and prompted by an enemy who says, I don't like you, whatever you are.
Right.
In other words, so you may as well wear the hat.
Yes, yes. I think those are the forces that encourage them, as it were.
I'll tell you a curious story about it. My grandmother, at the end of the war, bought some of the buildings from Tule Lake. She moved them to Southern Oregon.
Okay.
And my father put in the plumbing and the electricity for transient workers near her motel. So my job was to play, and I played in the ceiling, and I found a Japanese sword carved out of wood.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And that was my big prize. But I said to myself, well, this is a proud people. They're being told whatever they stand for, whatever they believe is worthless.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's perfectly reasonable. There would be elements that would say, oh, no, I stand by my identity. Right. Now, and tell us quickly about that. There is a lot of philosophy in your book. And matter of fact, I meant to, this, I'm going to combine two questions, philosophy and food. yes. And I'm looking at my watch, and I realize I'm going to ask you to read, if I could,
okay,
from page 289 of the – this is Terry Watata, The Three Pleasures, because it involves my question. If you have it there with you.
Oh, sure. You want me to read it now?
Yeah, if you would, please.
Oh, sure. In the Caslow camp's newly built Buddhist church hall, the women gathered early New Year's morning to begin cooking and preparing the celebratory dishes. Soga no Obasa made onigiri with a homemade umeboshi embedded within each and wrapped with shiso. For those who ate their sour tsukemono, it meant good health. Nakashima-san's matsutake mushrooms were a hit as always, very tender, even if they had been revived in water. People also brought along preserved freshwater fish from their abundant summer and fall catches. Irene and some of the Fujinkai women joined in with cookies they had made with flour and sugar from the Red Cross. I was just happy to be out of the office and away from all the bad news. There was no church service, though Tsuji-sensei visited for a short time and said a few words. It's hard to feel gratitude for our present state, but we are true Buddhists and must find things to be grateful for. The Security Commission has provided lumber to build more facilities. You have some running water thanks to Tasaka-san's ingenuity. Your children are getting an education because of Shimizu Hide-san. I understand the harvest was plentiful, and the government is providing. So none of you will starve. We are all blessed with a wonderful meal today, and I personally want to thank all the families who contributed. Let us join together in gratitude to the Buddha for all that we have.
That's beautiful. That's Terry Watata reading for The Three Pleasures. I don't know. I'll tell you, well, I was reading along in the book, and that passage, when I read this at the first opening, the women gathering to make a New Year's meal, and I began to cry.
Oh.
So I apologize for crying in your book. But and the strength is all in that, the three or four paragraphs here. But the Buddhism, we can get through this. Mm-hmm. We're thankful. But talking about some of the areas, some words like endurance or perseverance, how important are those words?
Well, they're a cultural concept, you know, gaman, you know, you persevere, you gather your strength and work through it. And it's been long held that the Japanese Canadians cooperated because there was no choice, you know, shikata ga nai, that's in the book as well. But I've learned during the research of the book that shikata ga nai means more than that. It really, really means I had no choice. I have to fight back because that is the reaction we must have towards this injustice. So gaman and doing what is right is at the central core of their beings.
And in this story, much of the time it is the women who are personifying that. The men are away. They are being abused, mocked, or whatever.
Yes.
And it falls on them. It's your shoulders.
Well, I look to my mother for that. I mean, she was left alone in Vancouver with her 10-year-old son, and not me.
Not you.
And she really had to work hard to survive.
Yes.
And yes, she asked friends, but still, you know, to go alone into the forest, right, the woods of BC and the mountains, what took a great deal of courage.
And finding that the things that could make a Japanese meal, because having a Japanese meal in the Beishi forest, you say, now that, you know, it's good for the soul.
It is, yes. Like you were talking about the matsutake.
Yeah, the man who found the mushrooms.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Bless his heart.
There are actually several tales of men scattered throughout the camps who found patches, and they would never tell where they were.
Very smart. This is Terry Watata. And lastly, I got to ask you, this book took a lot out of me, so did it take a lot out of you? This must be hard.
It took me 10 years to write.
How many?
10.
10.
With all the research. I'm talking about the research and the drafts and whatever else and the editing. Mm-hmm. But it touched on issues that most wouldn't touch. You know, for example, the rape scene. Yes. It really tore my heart out.
The two of us now. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
No, and I'm going to assume that happened.
Not
that moment. That way or in that moment.
That's right. That's right. There were hints in various Japanese-Canadian authors' books, mm-hmm. but no one really outlined what exactly happened.
Mm-hmm. You have a good line. Late in the book, Danny says, well, I buried my diaries.
Yes.
And he says, maybe somebody will find it, my diaries, and they will be a curious relic for an unknown past.
Right.
Great. Right. This book, Terry Watata, The Three Pleasures, is a curious relic from an unknown past. Except, well, we're making it known, of course. And I hope you're going to write more, but I really don't envy you the spiritual struggle that it takes to do this. Thank you very much for this interview.
Well, you're quite welcome.
We look forward to talking to you. Maybe if we could, we will do a part two or three, because there is, on the whole issue of Japanese Canadians, we're just scratching the surface with this. This book, The Three Pleasures, is a place to start.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Brayden, thank you very much. And she says it's going to be music to follow, and it's chosen by Terry Watana.
Well, it's my song.
It's his song. I'm too